This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Love on the Brain by Allie Hazelwood. Read for you by Brooke Bloomingdale. To my Grems. Insert dolphinboob.gif. 1. The Habenula. Disappointment. Here's my favorite piece of trivia in the whole world. Dr. Marie Sklodowska-Curie showed up to her wedding ceremony wearing her lab gown. It's actually a pretty cool story. A scientist friend hooked her up with Pierre Curie. They awkwardly admitted to having read each other's papers and flirted over beakers full of liquid uranium, and he proposed within the year. But Marie was only meant to be in France to get her degree, and reluctantly rejected him to return to Poland. Womp womp. Enter the University of Krakow, villain and unintentional Cupid of this story, which denied Marie a faculty position because she was a woman. Very classy, U of K. Dick move, I know, but it had the fortunate side effect of pushing Marie right back into Pierre's loving, not yet radioactive arms. Those two beautiful nerds married in 1895, and Marie, who wasn't exactly making bank at the time, bought herself a wedding dress that was comfortable enough to use in the lab every day. My girl was nothing if not pragmatic. Of course, this story becomes significantly less cool if you fast forward 10 years or so, to when Pierre got himself run over by a carriage and left Marie and their two daughters alone in the world. Zoom into 1906, and that's where you'll find the real moral of this tale. Trusting people to stick around is a bad idea. One way or another, they'll end up gone. Maybe they'll slip on the Rue Dauphine on a rainy morning and get their skull crushed by a horse-drawn cart. Maybe they'll be kidnapped by aliens and vanish into the vastness of space. Or maybe they'll have sex with your best friend 6 months before you're due to get married, forcing you to call off the wedding and lose tons of cash in security deposits. The sky's the limit, really. One might say, then, that U of K is only a minor villain. Don't get me wrong. I love picturing Dr. Curie waltzing back to Krakow, Pretty Woman style, wearing her wedding-slash-lab gown, brandishing her two Nobel Prize medals, and yelling, "Big mistake, big, huge." But the real villain, the one that had Marie crying and staring at the ceiling in the late hours of the night, is loss, grief, the intrinsic transience of human relationships. The real villain is love, an unstable isotope constantly undergoing spontaneous nuclear decay. And it will forever go unpunished. Do you know what's reliable instead? What never, ever abandoned Dr. Curie in all her years? Her curiosity, her discoveries, her accomplishments. Science. Science is where it's at. Which is why when NASA notifies me, B. Koenigswasser, that I've been chosen as lead investigator of BLINK, one of their most prestigious neuroimaging research projects, I screech. I screech loudly and joyously in my minuscule, windowless office on the Bethesda campus of the National Institutes of Health. I screech about the amazing performance-enhancing technology I'm going to get to build for none other than NASA astronauts. And then I remember that the walls are toilet paper thin, and that my left neighbor once filed a formal complaint against me for listening to 90s female alt-rock without headphones. So I press the back of my hand to my mouth, bite into it, and jump up and down as silently as possible while elation explodes inside me. I feel just like I imagine Dr. Curie must have felt when she was finally allowed to enroll at the University of Paris in late 1891, as though a world of preferably non-radioactive scientific discoveries is finally within grasping distance. It is by far the most momentous day of my life and kicks off a phenomenal weekend of celebrations. Highlights are: I tell the news to my three favorite colleagues, and we go out to our usual bar, guzzle several rounds of lemon drops, and take turns doing hilarious impressions of that time Trevor, our ugly middle-aged boss, asked us not to fall in love with him. Academic men tend to harbor many delusions. Except for Pierre Curie, of course. Pierre would never. I change my hair from pink to purple. I have to do it at home, because junior academics can't afford salons. My shower ends up looking like a mix between a cotton candy machine and a unicorn slaughterhouse. But after the raccoon incident, which believe me, you don't want to know about, I wasn't going to get my security deposit back anyway. I take myself to Victoria's Secret and buy a set of pretty green lingerie, not allowing myself to feel guilty at the expense, even though it's been many years since someone has seen me without clothes. And if I have my way, no one will for many, many more. I download the couch to marathon plan I've been meaning to start and do my first run. Then I limp back home, cursing my overambition, and promptly downgrade to a couch to 5K program. I can't believe that some people work out every day. I bake treats for Phineas, my elderly neighbor's equally elderly cat, who often visits my apartment for second dinner. He shreds my favorite pair of Converse in gratitude. Dr. Curie, in her infinite wisdom, was probably a dog person. In short, I have an absolute blast. I'm not even sad when Monday comes. It's same old, same old. Experiments, lab meetings, eating lean cuisine, and shotgunning store brand LaCroix at my desk while crunching data. But with the prospect of Blink, even the old feels new and exciting. I'll be honest, I've been worried sick. After having 4 grant applications rejected in less than 6 months, I was sure that my career was stalling, maybe even over. Whenever Trevor called me into his office, I'd get palpitations and sweaty palms, sure that he'd tell me that my yearly contract wasn't going to be renewed. The last couple of years since graduating with my PhD haven't been a whole lot of fun. But that's over with. Contracting for NASA is a career-making opportunity. After all, I've been chosen after a ruthless selection process over golden boys like Josh Martin, Hank Malik, even Jan Vanderberg, that horrid guy who trash-talks my research like it's an Olympic sport. I've had my setbacks, plenty of them, but after nearly 2 decades of being obsessed with the brain, here I am, lead neuroscientist of Blink. I'll design gears for astronauts, gears they'll use in space. This is how I get out of Trevor's clammy, sexist clutches. This is what buys me a long-term contract and my own lab with my own line of research. This is the turning point in my professional life, which, truthfully, is the only kind of life I care to have. For several days, I'm ecstatic. I'm exhilarated. I'm ecstatically exhilarated. Then, on Monday at 4:33 p.m., my email pings with a message from NASA. I read the name of the person who will be co-leading Blink with me, and all of a sudden, I'm none of those things anymore. Do you remember Levi Ward?
Brennt da etwas? Ah.
Over the phone, Marijke's voice is thick and sleep-laden, muffled by poor reception and long distance.
B, is that you? What time is it?
8:15 in Maryland and... I rapidly calculate the time difference. A few weeks ago, Rika was in Tajikistan, but now she's in Portugal, maybe? 2 a.m. your time. Rika grunts, groans, moans, and makes a whole host of other sounds I'm all too familiar with from sharing a room with her for the first 2 decades of our lives. I sit back on my couch and wait it out until she asks,
"Who died?"
"No one died. Well, I'm sure someone died, but no one we know. Were you really sleeping? Are you sick? Should I fly out?" I'm genuinely concerned that my sister isn't out clubbing or skinny dipping in the Mediterranean Sea or frolicking with a coven of warlocks based in the forests of the Iberian Peninsula. Sleeping at night is very out of character.
"Nah, I ran out of money again,"
she yawns.
"Been giving private lessons to rich, spoiled Portuguese boys during the day until I make enough to fly to Norway."
I know better than to ask, why Norway? since Rika's answer would just be, "Why not?" Instead, I go with, "Do you need me to send you some money? I'm not exactly flush with cash, especially after my days of premature, as it turns out, celebrations. But I could spare a few dollars if I'm careful. And don't eat for a couple of days."
"Nah, the brat's parents pay well. Ugh, B, a 12-year-old tried to touch my boob yesterday."
"Gross. What did you do?"
"I told him I'd cut off his fingers, of course. Anyway, to what do I owe the pleasure of being brutally awakened? I'm sorry." "Nah, you're not."
I smile. "Nah, I'm not. What's the point of sharing 100% of your DNA with a person if you can't wake them up for an emergency chat? Remember that research project I mentioned? Blink?"
"The one you're leading? NASA? Where you use your fancy brain science to build those fancy helmets to make fancy astronauts better in space?"
"Yes, sort of. As it turns out, I'm not leading as much as co-leading. The funds come from NIH and NASA. They got into a pissing contest over which agency should be in charge and ultimately decided to have two leaders." In the corner of my eye, I notice a flash of orange. Phineas lounging on the sill of my kitchen window. I let him in with a few scratches on the head. He meows lovingly and licks my hand. "Do you remember Levi Ward?"
"Is he some guy I dated who's trying to reach me because he has gonorrhea?"
"Huh? No. He's someone I met in grad school." I open the cupboard where I keep the whiskas. "He was getting a PhD in engineering in my lab and was in his fifth year when I started."
"The Ward ass?"
"Yep, him."
"I remember. Wasn't he like hot, tall, built?"
I bite back a smile, pouring food in Phineas's bowl.
"I'm not sure how I feel about the fact that the only thing you remember about my grad school nemesis is that he was 6'4".
Dr. Marie Curie sisters, renowned physician Bronisława Duska, and educational activist Helena Shalayeva would never, unless they were thirsty wenches like Rika, in which case they absolutely would.
"And built. You should just be proud of my elephantine memory."
"And I am. Anyway, I was told who the NASA co-lead for my project will be, and..."
"No way."
Rika must have sat up. Her voice is suddenly crystal clear.
"No way."
"Yes way." I listen to my sister's maniacal, gleeful cackling while I toss the empty pouch.
"You know, you could at least pretend not to enjoy this so much."
"Oh, I could. But will I?"
"Clearly not."
"Did you cry when you found out?"
"No."
"Did you head desk?"
"No."
"Don't lie to me." "Do you have a bump on your forehead?" "Maybe a small one."
"Oh, B, thank you for waking me up to share this outstanding piece of news. Isn't the Ward ass the guy who said that you were fugly?"
"He never did. At least, not in those terms." But I laugh so loud, Phineas gives me a startled glance.
"I can't believe you remember that."
"Hey, I resented it a lot. You're hot AF." "You only say so because I look exactly like you." "Why, I hadn't even noticed." It's not completely true anyway. Yes, Rika and I are both short and slight. We have the same symmetrical features and blue eyes, the same straight dark hair. Still, we've long outgrown our parent trap stage, and at 28, no one would struggle to tell us apart. Not when my hair has been different shades of pastel colors for the past decade, or with my love for piercings and the occasional tattoo. Rika, with her wanderlust and artistic inclinations, is the true free spirit of the family. But she can never be bothered to make free spirit fashion statements. That's where I, the supposedly boring scientist, come in to pick up the slack.
So was he? The one who insulted me by proxy?
Yep, Levi Ward, the one and only. I pour water into a bowl for Phineas. It didn't go quite that way. Levi never explicitly insulted me. Implicitly, though. I gave my first academic talk in my second semester of grad school, and I took it very seriously. I memorized the entire speech, redid the PowerPoint 6 times, even agonized over the perfect outfit. I ended up dressing nicer than usual, and Annie, my grad school best friend, had the well-meaning but unfortunate idea to rope Levi into complimenting me. "Doesn't Bea look extra pretty today?" It was probably the only topic of conversation she could think of. After all, Annie was always going on about how mysteriously handsome he was, with the dark hair and the broad shoulders and that interesting, unusual face of his. How she wished he'd stop being so reserved and ask her out. Except that Levi didn't seem interested in conversation. He studied me intensely with those piercing green eyes of his. He stared at me from head to toe for several moments. And then he said, "Nothing. Absolutely nothing." He just made what Tim, my ex-fiancé, later referred to as an aghast expression, and walked out of the lab with a wooden nod and 0 compliments. Not even a stilted fake one. After that, grad school, the ultimate cesspool of gossip, did its thing, and the story took on a life of its own. Students said that he'd puked all over my dress, that he'd begged me on his knees to put a paper bag over my head, that he'd been so horrified he'd tried to cleanse his brain by drinking bleach and suffered irreparable neurological damage as a consequence. I try not to take myself too seriously, and being part of a meme of sorts was amusing. But the rumors were so wild, I started to wonder if I really was revolting. Still, I never blamed Levi. I never resented him for refusing to be strong-armed into pretending that he found me attractive. Or, well, not repulsive. He always seemed like such a man's man, after all. Different from the boys that surrounded me. Serious, disciplined, a little broody, intense and gifted. Alpha, whatever that even means. A girl with a septum piercing and a blue ombre wouldn't conform to his ideals of what pretty ladies should look like. And that's fine. What I do resent Levi for are his other behaviors during the year we overlapped. Like the fact that he never bothered to meet my eyes when I talked to him, or that he always found excuses not to come to journal club when it was my turn to present. I reserve the right to be angry for how he'd slip out of a group conversation the moment I joined, for considering me so beneath his notice that he never even said hi when I walked into the lab, for the way I caught him staring at me with an intense, displeased expression, as though I were some eldritch abomination. I reserve the right to feel bitter that after Tim and I got engaged, Levi pulled him aside and told him that he could do much better than me. Come on, who does that? Most of all, I reserve the right to detest him for making it clear that he believed me to be a mediocre scientist. The rest I could have overlooked easily enough, but the lack of respect for my work? I'll forever grind my axe for that. That is, until I wedge it in his groin. Levi became my sworn archenemy on a Tuesday in April in my PhD advisor's office. Samantha Lee was, and still is, the bomb when it comes to neuroimaging. If there's a way to study a living human's brains without cracking their skull open, Sam either came up with it or mastered it. Her research is brilliant, well-funded, and highly interdisciplinary, hence the variety of PhD students she mentored. Cognitive neuroscientists like me, interested in studying the neural basis of behavior. But also computer scientists, biologists, psychologists, engineers. Even in the crowded chaos of Sam's lab, Levi stood out. He had a knack for the type of problem-solving Sam liked, the one that elevates neuroimaging to an art. In his first year, he figured out a way to build a portable infrared spectroscopy machine that had been puzzling postdocs for a decade. By his third, he'd revolutionized the lab's data analysis pipeline. In his fourth, he got a science publication. And in his fifth, when I joined the lab, Sam called us together into her office. "There is this amazing project I've been wanting to kickstart," she said with her usual enthusiasm. "If we manage to make it work, it's going to change the entire landscape of the field. And that's why I need my best neuroscientist and my best engineer to collaborate on it." It was a breezy, early spring afternoon. I remember it well, because that morning had been unforgettable. Tim on one knee, in the middle of the lab, proposing. A bit theatrical, not really my thing. But I wasn't going to complain, not when it meant someone wanted to stand by me for good. So I looked him in the eyes, choked back the tears, and said yes. A few hours later, I felt the engagement ring bite painfully into my clenched fist.
"I don't have time for a collaboration, Sam,"
Levi said. He was standing as far away from me as he could, and yet he still managed to fill the small office and become its center of gravity. He didn't bother to glance at me. He never did. Sam frowned.
"The other day you said you'd be on board."
"I misspoke."
His expression was unreadable, uncompromising.
"Sorry, Sam. I'm just too busy."
I cleared my throat and took a few steps toward him.
"I know I'm just a first-year student," I started appeasingly. "But I can do my part. I promise, and—
"That's not it,"
he said. His eyes briefly caught mine, green and black and stormy cold. And for a brief moment, he seemed stuck, as though he couldn't look away. My heart stumbled.
"Like I said, I don't have time right now to take on new projects."
I don't remember why I walked out of the office alone, nor why I decided to linger right outside. I told myself that it was fine. Levi was just busy. Everyone was busy. Academia was nothing but a bunch of busy people running around busily. I myself was super busy, because Sam was right. I was one of the best neuroscientists in the lab. I had plenty of my own work going on. Until I overheard Sam's concerned question.
"Why did you change your mind? You said that the project was going to be a slam dunk."
"I know, but I can't. I'm sorry."
"Can't what?"
"Work with B."
Sam asked him why, but I didn't stop to listen. Pursuing any kind of graduate education requires a healthy dose of masochism, but I drew the line at sticking around while someone trash-talked me to my boss. I stormed off. And by the following week, when I heard Annie chattering happily about the fact that Levi had agreed to help her on her thesis project, I'd long stopped lying to myself. Levi Ward, his wardness, Dr. Wardass, despised me. Me. Specifically me. Yes, he was a taciturn, somber, brooding mountain of a man. He was private, an introvert. His temperament was reserved and aloof. I couldn't demand that he like me, and had no intention of doing so. Still, if he could be civil, polite, even friendly with everyone else, he could have made an effort with me, too. But no, Levi Ward clearly despised me, and in the face of such hatred, well, I had no choice but to hate him back. "You there?" Rika asks. "Yeah," I mumble. "Just ruminating about Levi."
"He's at NASA then?
Dare I hope he'll be sent to Mars to retrieve Curiosity?"
"Sadly, not before he's done co-leading my project."
In the past few years, while my career gasped for air like a hippo with sleep apnea, Levi's thrived, obnoxiously so. He published interesting studies, got a huge Department of Defense grant, and, according to an email Sam sent around, even made Forbes's 10 Under 40 list, the science edition. The only reason I've been able to stand his successes without falling on my sword is that his research has been gravitating away from neuroimaging. This made us not quite competitors, and allowed me to just never think about him. An excellent life hack. Which worked superbly. Until today. Honestly, fuck today.
I'm still enjoying this immensely, but I'll make an effort to be sisterly and sympathetic. How concerned are you to be working with him? On a scale from 1 to heavily breathing into a paper bag.
I tip what's left of Phineas's water into a pot of daisies. I think having to work with someone who thinks I'm a shit scientist warrants at least 2 inhalers.
You're amazing. You're the best scientist.
Aw, thank you. I choose to believe that Rika filing astrology and crystallotherapy under the label science only slightly detracts from the compliment. It's going to be horrible, the worst. If he's anything like he used to be, I'm going to... Rika, are you peeing?
A beat, filled by the noise of running water.
Maybe. Hey, you're the one who woke me and my bladder up. Please carry on.
I smile and shake my head. If he's anything like he was at Pitt, he's going to be a nightmare to work with. Plus, I'll be on his turf.
Right, 'cause you're moving to Houston.
For 3 months. My research assistant and I are leaving next week.
I'm jealous. I'm going to be stuck here in Portugal for who knows how long, groped by knockoff Joffrey Baratheons who refuse to learn what a subjunctive is. I'm rotting, B.
It will never cease to befuddle me how differently Rika and I reacted to being thrown around like rubber balls during childhood, both before and after our parents' death. We were bounced from one extended family member to another, lived in a dozen countries, and all Rika wants is to live in even more countries, travel, see new places, experience new things. It's like yearning for change is hardwired in her brain. She packed up the day we graduated high school and has been making her way through the continents for the past decade, complaining about being bored after a handful of weeks in one place. I'm the opposite. I want to put down roots, security, stability. I thought I'd get it with Tim. But like I said, relying on others is risky business. Permanence and love are clearly incompatible. So now I'm focusing on my career. I want a long-term position as an NIH scientist, and landing Blink is the perfect stepping stone.
You know what just occurred to me?
You forgot to flush?
Can't flush at night. Noisy European pipes. If I do, my neighbor leaves passive-aggressive notes. But hear me out. 3 years ago, when I spent that summer harvesting watermelons in Australia, I met this guy from Houston. He was a riot. Cute, too. But I can find his email and ask him if he's single.
Nope. He had really pretty eyes and could touch the tip of his nose with his tongue. That's like 10% of the population. I make a mental note to look up whether that's true. I'm going there to work, not to date nose-tongue guy.
You could do both.
I don't date.
Why?
You know why.
No, actually.
Rika's tone takes on its usual stubborn quality.
Listen, I know that the last time you dated, I was engaged.
Same difference. Maybe things didn't go well. I lift one eyebrow at the most euphemistic euphemism I've ever heard.
And you want to feel safe and practice maintenance of your emotional boundaries. But that can't prevent you from ever dating again. You can't put all your eggs into the science basket.
There are other, better baskets.
Like the sex basket, and the making out basket, and the letting a boy pay for your expensive vegan dinner basket, and...
Phineas chooses this very moment to meow loudly. Bless his little feline timing.
Bee, did you get that kitten you've been talking about?
It's the neighbors. I lean over to nuzzle him, a silent thank you for distracting my sister mid-sermon.
If you don't want to date nose-tongue guy, at least get a damn cat.
You already have that stupid name picked out.
Meowry Curie is a great name.
And no,
it's your childhood dream. Remember when we were in Austria? How we'd play Harry Potter and your Patronus was always a kitten?
And yours was a blobfish. I smile. We read the books together in German, just a few weeks before moving to our maternal cousins in the UK, who wasn't exactly thrilled to have us stay in her minuscule spare room. Ugh, I hate moving. I'm sad to leave my objectively crappy but dearly beloved Bethesda apartment. Anyway, Harry Potter is tainted forever, and I'm not getting a cat. Why? Because it will die in 13 to 17 years based on recent statistical data and shatter my heart in 13 to 17 pieces. Oh, for fuck's sake. I'll settle for loving other people's cats and never knowing when they pass away. I hear a thud, probably Rika throwing herself back into bed. You know what your condition is. It's called not a condition. We've been over avoidant attachment. You're pathologically independent and don't let others come close out of fear that they'll eventually leave you. You have erected a fence around you, the bee fence, and are terrified of anything resembling emotional. Rika's voice fades into a jaw-breaking yawn, and I feel a wave of affection for her. Even though her favorite pastime is entering my personality traits into WebMD and diagnosing me with imaginary disorders. Go to bed, Rika. I'll call you soon. Yeah, okay. Another small yawn. But I'm right, Beach, and you're wrong. Of course. Good night, babe. I hang up and spend a few more minutes petting Phineas. When he slips out to the fresh breeze of the early spring night, I begin to pack. As I fold my skinny jeans and colorful tops, I come across something I haven't seen in a while. A dress with yellow polka dots over blue cotton, the same blue of Dr. Curie's wedding gown. Target, spring collection, circa 5 million years ago. $12, give or take. It's the one I was wearing when Levi decided that I am but a sentient bunion, the most repugnant of nature's creatures. I shrug and stuff it into my suitcase. 2. Vagus nerve. Blackout. By the way, you can get leprosy from armadillos. I peel my nose away from the airplane window and glance at Rocio, my research assistant. Really? Yep. They got it from humans millennia ago, and now they're giving it back to us. She shrugs. Revenge and cold dishes and all that. I scrutinize her beautiful face for hints that she's lying. Her large, dark eyes, heavily rimmed with eyeliner, are inscrutable. Her hair is so Vanta black it absorbs 99% of visible light. Her mouth is full, curved downward in its typical pout. Nope, I got nothing. Is this for real? Would I ever lie to you? Last week you swore to me that Stephen King was writing a Winnie the Pooh spinoff, and I believed her. Like I believed that Lady Gaga is a known Satanist, or that badminton rackets are made from human bones and intestines. Chaotic goth misanthropy and creepy deadpan sarcasm are her brand, and I should know better than to take her seriously. Problem is, every once in a while, she'll throw in a crazy-sounding story that upon further inspection, i.e. a Google search, is revealed to be true. For instance, did you know that the Texas Chainsaw Massacre was inspired by a true story? Before Rocio, I didn't, and I slept significantly better. Don't believe me then. She shrugs, going back to her grad school admission prep book. Go pet the leper armadillos and die. She's such a weirdo. I adore her. Hey, you sure you're going to be fine? Away from Alex for the next few months? I feel a little guilty for taking her away from her boyfriend. When I was 22, if someone had asked me to be apart from Tim for months, I'd have walked into the sea. Then again, hindsight has proven beyond doubt that I was a complete idiot. And Rocio seems pretty enthused over the opportunity. She plans to apply to Johns Hopkins' neuro program in the fall, and the NASA line on her CV won't hurt. She even hugged me when I offered her the chance to come along. A moment of weakness I'm sure she deeply regrets. Fine. Are you kidding?
She looks at me like I'm insane. 3 months in Texas? Do you know how many times I'll get to see La Llorona?
La what?
She rolls her eyes and pops in her AirPods. You really know nothing about famed feminist ghosts. I bite back a smile and turn back to the window. In 1905, Dr. Curie decided to invest her Nobel Prize money into hiring her first research assistant. I wonder if she, too, ended up working with a mildly terrifying Cthulhu-worshipping emo girl. I stare at the clouds until I'm bored, and then I take my phone out of my pocket and connect to the complimentary in-flight Wi-Fi. I glance at Rocio, making sure that she's not paying attention to me, and angle my screen away. I'm not a very secretive person, mostly out of laziness. I refuse to take on the cognitive labor of tracking lies and omissions. I do, however, have one secret. One single piece of information that I've never shared with anyone, not even my sister. Don't get me wrong, I trust Rika with my life. But I also know her well enough to picture the scene. She is wearing a flowy sundress, flirting with a Scottish shepherd she met in a trattoria on the Amalfi Coast. They decide to do the shrooms they just purchased from a Belarusian farmer, and mid-trip she accidentally blurts out the one thing she's been expressly forbidden to repeat. Her twin sister, B, runs one of the most popular and controversial accounts on academic Twitter. The Scottish shepherd's cousin is a closeted men's rights activist who sends me a dead possum in the mail, rats me out to his insane friends, and I get fired. No, thank you. I love my job and possums too much for this. I created @WhatWouldMarieDo during my first semester of grad school. I was teaching a neuroanatomy class and decided to give my students an anonymous mid-semester survey to ask for honest feedback on how to improve the course. What I got was not that. I was told that my lectures would be more interesting if I delivered them naked, that I should gain some weight, get a boob job, stop dyeing my hair, unnatural colors, get rid of my piercings. I was even given a phone number to call if I was ever in the mood for a 10-inch dick. Yeah, right. The messages were pretty appalling, but what sent me sobbing in a bathroom stall was the reactions of the other students in my cohort. Tim included. They laughed the comments off as harmless pranks and dissuaded me from reporting them to the department chair, telling me that I'd be making a stink about nothing. They were, of course, all men. Seriously, why are men? That night, I fell asleep crying. The following day, I got up, wondered how many other women in STEM felt as alone as I did, and impulsively downloaded Twitter and made @WhatWouldMarieDo. I slapped on a poorly photoshopped pic of Dr. Curie wearing sunglasses and a one-line bio, making the periodic table girlier since 1889, she/her. I just wanted to scream into the void. I honestly didn't think that anyone would even see my first tweet, but I was wrong. @WhatWouldMarieDo. What would Dr. Curie, first female professor at La Sorbonne, do if one of her students asked her to deliver her lectures naked? @198888, she would shorten his half-life. @Anna, rat him out to Pierre. @Emily89, put some polonium in his pants and watch his dick shrivel. @Bioworm55, nuke him, nuke him. @LucyInTheSea, has this happened to you? God, I'm so sorry. Once a student said something about my ass, and it was so gross, and no one believed me. Over half a decade later, after a handful of Chronicle of Higher Education nods, a New York Times article, and about a million followers, WWMD is my happy place. What's best is, I think the same is true for many others. The account has evolved into a therapeutic community of sorts, used by women in STEM to tell their stories, exchange advice, and bitch. Oh, we bitch. We bitch a lot, and it's glorious. @BiologySarah. Hey, @WhatWouldMarieDo,
If she weren't given authorship on a project that was originally her idea and that she worked on for over 1 year, all other authors are men because, of course, they are.
Yikes.
I scrunch my face and quote tweet Sarah. Marie would slip some radium in their coffee. Also, she would consider reporting this to her institution's Office of Research Integrity, making sure to document every step of the process. I hit send, drum my fingers on the armrest, and wait. My answers are not the main attraction of the account, not in the least. The real reason people reach out to WWMD is... yep. This. I feel my grin widen as the replies start coming in. At Dr. Alex, this happened to me too. I was the only woman and only POC in the author lineup, and my name suddenly disappeared during revisions. DM if you want to chat, Sarah. At Amy Bernard, I am a member of the Women in Science Association, and we have advice for situations like this on our website. They're sadly common. At The Geologician, going through the same situation right now, at Biology Sarah. I did report it to ORI, and it's still unfolding, but I'm happy to talk if you need to vent. At Steve Harrison, dude, breaking news, you're lying to yourself. Your contributions aren't valuable enough to warrant authorship. Your team did you a favor letting you tag along for a while, but if you're not smart enough, you're out. Not everything is about being a woman. Sometimes you're just a loser. It is a truth universally acknowledged that a community of women trying to mind their own business must be in want of a random man's opinion. I've long learned that engaging with basement-dwelling STEM lords who come online looking for a fight is never a good idea. The last thing I want is to provide free entertainment for their fragile egos. If they want to blow off some steam, they can buy a gym membership or play third-person shooter video games like normal people. I make to hide at Stephen Harrison's delightful contribution, but notice that someone has replied to him. At Schmacademics. Yeah, Marie, sometimes you're just a loser. Steve would know. I chuckle. At What Would Marie Do? Aw, Steve, don't be too hard on yourself. At Schmacademics. He is just a boy, standing in front of a girl, asking her to do twice as much work as he ever did in order to prove that she's worthy of becoming a scientist. At What Would Marie Do? Steve, you old romantic. At Steve Harrison. Fuck you. This ridiculous push for women in STEM is ruining STEM. People should get jobs because they're good, not because they have vaginas. But now people feel like they have to hire women, and they get jobs over men who are more qualified. This is the end of STEM, and it's wrong. At What Would Marie Do? I can see you're upset about this, Steve. At Schmacademics. They're there. Steve blocks both of us, and I chuckle again, drawing a curious glance from Rocio. At Schmacademics is another hugely popular account on academic Twitter, and by far my favorite. He mostly tweets about how he should be writing, makes fun of elitism and ivory tower academics, and points out bad or biased science. I was initially a bit distrustful of him. His bio says he/him, and we all know how cis men on the internet can be. But he and I ended up forming an alliance of sorts. When the STEM lords take offense at the sheer idea of women in STEM and start pitchforking in my mentions, he helps me ridicule them a little. I'm not sure when we started direct messaging. When I stopped being afraid that he was secretly a retired gamer gator out to dox me, or when I began considering him a friend. But a handful of years later, here we are, chatting about half a dozen different things a couple of times a week, without having even exchanged real names. Is it weird, knowing that Schmack had lice 3 times in second grade, but not which time zone he lives in? A bit. But it's also liberating. Plus, having opinions online can be very dangerous. The internet is a sea full of creepy, cyber-criminal fish. And if Mark Zuckerberg can cover his laptop webcam with a piece of tape, I reserve the right to keep things painfully anonymous. The flight attendant offers me a glass of water from a tray. I shake my head, smile, and DM Schmack. Marie, I think Steve doesn't want to play with us anymore.
Schmack,
I think Steve wasn't held enough as a tadpole.
Marie, LOL.
Schmack,
how's life?
Marie, good. Cool new project starting next week. My ticket away from my gross boss.
Schmack,
can't believe dude's still around.
Marie, the power of connections and inertia. What about you?
Schmack,
work's interesting.
Marie,
good interesting?
Schmack,
politicky interesting, so no.
Marie, I'm afraid to ask. How's the rest?
Schmack,
weird.
Marie, did your cat poop in your shoe again?
Schmack,
no, but I did find a tomato in my boot the other day.
Marie, send pics next time. What's going on?
Schmack,
nothing really.
Marie, oh, come on.
Schmack,
how do you even know something's going on?
Marie, your lack of exclamation points.
Schmack,
he replies with 11 exclamation points.
Marie,
Schmack.
Schmack,
FYI, I'm sighing deeply.
Marie, I bet. Tell me.
Schmack,
it's a girl.
Marie, ooh, tell me everything.
Schmack,
there isn't much to tell.
Marie, did you just meet her?
Schmack,
no, she's someone I've known for a long time, and now she's back.
Schmack,
and she is married.
Marie, to you?
Schmack,
depressingly no.
Schmack,
sorry, we're restructuring the lab. Gotta go before someone destroys a $5 million piece of equipment. Talk later.
Marie,
sure, but I'll want to know everything about your affair with a married woman.
Schmack,
I wish.
It's nice to know that Schmack is always a click away, especially now that I'm flying into the Wardass's frosty, unwelcoming lap. I switch to my email app to check if Levi has finally answered the email I sent 3 days ago. It was just a couple of lines. Hey, long time no see. I look forward to working together again. Would you like to meet to discuss Blink this weekend? But he must have been too busy to reply. Or too full of contempt. Or both. Ugh. I lean back against the headrest and close my eyes, wondering how Dr. Curie would deal with Levi Ward. She'd probably hide some radioactive isotopes in his pockets, grab popcorn and watch nuclear decay work its magic. Yep, sounds about right. After a few minutes, I fall asleep. I dream that Levi is part armadillo. His skin glows a faint, sallow green, and he's digging a tomato out of his boot with an expensive piece of equipment. Even with all of that, the weirdest thing about him is that he's finally being nice to me. We're put up in small furnished apartments in a lodging facility just outside the Johnson Space Center, only a couple of minutes from the Sullivan Discovery Building, where we'll be working. I can't believe how short my commute is going to be.
Bet you'll still manage to be late all the time, Rocio tells me, and I glare at her while unlocking my door.
It's not my fault if I've spent a sizable chunk of my formative years in Italy, where time is but a polite suggestion. The place is considerably nicer than the apartment I rent, maybe because of the raccoon incident, probably because I buy 90% of my furniture from the as-is bargain corner at IKEA. It has a balcony, a dishwasher, and huge improvement in my quality of life, a toilet that flushes 100% of the times I push the lever. Truly paradigm shifting. I excitedly open and close every single cupboard. They're all empty. I'm not sure what I expected. Take pictures to send Rika and my coworkers. Stick my favorite Marie Curie magnet to the fridge. A picture of her holding a beaker that says, I'm pretty rad. Hang my hummingbird feeder on the balcony and then... It's still only 2:30 p.m. Ugh. Not that I'm one of those people who hates having free time. I could easily spend 5 solid hours napping, rewatching an entire season of The Office while eating Twizzlers, or moving to step 2 of the Couch to 5K plan I'm still very, okay, sort of committed to. But I am here, in Houston, near the Space Center, about to start the coolest project of my life. It's Friday, and I'm not due to check in until Monday, but I'm brimming with nervous energy. So I text Rocio to ask whether she wants to check out the Space Center with me. No, or grab dinner together. I only eat animal carcasses. She's so mean. I love her. My first impression of Houston is big, closely followed by humid, and then by humidly big. In Maryland, remnants of snow still cling to the ground, but the Space Center is already lush and green, a mix of open spaces and large buildings and old NASA aircraft on display. There are families visiting, which makes it seem a little like an amusement park. I can't believe I'm going to be seeing rockets on my way to work for the next 3 months. It sure beats the perv crossing guard who works on the NIH campus. The Discovery Building is on the outskirts of the center. It's wide, futuristic, and three-storied, with glass walls and a complicated-looking stair system I can't quite figure out. I step inside the marble hall, wondering if my new office will have a window. I'm not used to natural light. The sudden intake of vitamin D might kill me. I'm Bea Koenigwasser. I smile at the receptionist. I'm starting work here on Monday, and I was wondering if I could take a look around. He gives me an apologetic smile.
I can't let you in if you don't have an ID badge. The engineering labs are upstairs, high security areas.
Right. Yes. The engineering labs. Levi's at labs. He's probably up there hard at work. Engineering, labbing, not answering my emails. No problem. That's understandable. I'll just...
Dr. Koenigwasser? B.
I turn around. There is a blonde young man behind me. He's non-threateningly handsome, medium height, smiling at me like we're old friends, even though he doesn't look familiar. Hi?
I didn't mean to eavesdrop, but I caught your name and... I'm Guy. Guy Kowalski?
The name clicks immediately. I break into a grin. Guy! It's so nice to meet you in person. When I was first notified of Blink, Guy was my point of contact for logistics questions, and he and I emailed back and forth a few times. He's an astronaut, an actual astronaut, working on Blink while he's grounded. He seemed so familiar with the project, I initially assumed he'd be my co-lead. He shakes my hand warmly.
I love your work. I've read all your articles. You'll be such an asset to the project.
Likewise, I can't wait to collaborate. If I weren't dehydrated from the flight, I'd probably tear up. I cannot believe that this man, this nice, pleasant man who has given me more positive interactions in 1 minute than Dr. Wardass did in 1 year, could have been my co-lead. I must have pissed off some god. Zeus? Eros? Must be Poseidon. Shouldn't have peed in the Baltic Sea during my misspent youth.
Why don't I show you around? You can come in as my guest.
He nods to the receptionist and gestures at me to follow him. I wouldn't want to take you away from... astronauting?
I'm between missions. Giving you a tour beats debugging any day.
He shrugs. Something boyishly charming about him. We'll get along great. I already know it. Have you lived in Houston long? I ask as we step into the elevator.
About 8 years. Came to NASA right out of grad school. Applied for the astronaut corps, did the training, then a mission.
I do some math in my head. It would put him in his mid-30s, older than I initially thought.
The past 2 or so, I worked on Blink's precursor, engineering the structure of the helmet, figuring out the wireless system. But we got to a point where we needed a neurostimulation expert on board.
He gives me a warm smile. I cannot wait to see what we cook up together. I also cannot wait to find out why Levi was given the lead of this project over someone who has been on it for years. It just seems unfair to Guy and to me. The elevator doors open, and he points to a quaint-looking cafe in the corner.
That place over there? Amazing sandwiches. Worst coffee in the world. You hungry?
No, thanks.
You sure? It's on me. The egg sandwiches are almost as good as the coffee is bad.
I don't really eat eggs.
Let me guess, a vegan?
I nod. I try hard to break the stereotypes that plague my people and not use the word vegan in my first 3 meetings with a new acquaintance. But if they're the ones to mention it, all bets are off.
I should introduce you to my daughter. She recently announced that she won't eat animal products anymore.
He sighs.
Last weekend, I poured regular milk in her cereal, figuring she wouldn't know the difference. She told me that her legal team will be in touch.
How old is she?
Just turned 6.
I laugh. Good luck with that. I stopped having meat at 7 when I realized that the delicious pollo nuggets my Sicilian grandmother served nearly every day and the cute galline grazing about the farm were more connected than I'd originally suspected. Stunning plot twist, I know. Rika wasn't nearly as distraught when I frantically explained that pigs have families too, a mom and a dad and siblings that will miss them. She just nodded thoughtfully and said, "What you're saying is we should eat the whole family?" I went fully vegan a couple of years later. Meanwhile, my sister has made it her life's goal to eat enough animal products for 2. Together, we emit 1 normal person's carbon footprint.
The engineering labs are down this hallway,
Guy says. The space is an interesting mix of glass and wood, and I can see inside some of the rooms.
A bit cluttered, and most people are off today. We're shuffling around equipment and reorganizing the space. We've got lots of ongoing projects, but Blink's everyone's favorite child. The other astronauts pop by every once in a while just to ask how much longer it will be until their fancy swag is ready.
I grin. For real?
Yep.
Making fancy swag for astronauts is my literal job description. I can add it to my LinkedIn profile. Not that anyone uses LinkedIn.
The neuroscience labs, your labs, will be on the right. This way there are...
His phone rings.
Sorry, mind if I take it?
Not at all. I smile at his beaver phone case, nature's engineer, and look away. I wonder whether Guy would think I'm lame if I snapped a few pictures of the building for my friends. I decide that I can live with that. But when I take out my phone, I hear a noise from down the hallway. It's soft and chirpy and sounds a lot like a
meow.
I glance back at Guy. He's busy explaining how to put on Moana to someone very young, so I decide to investigate. Most of the rooms are deserted, labs full of large, abstruse equipment that looks like it belongs to, well, NASA. I hear male voices somewhere in the building, but no sign of the
meow.
I turn around. A few feet away, staring at me with a curious expression, is a beautiful young calico. And who might you be? I slowly hold out my hand. The kitten comes closer, delicately sniffs my fingers, and gives me a welcoming headbutt. I laugh. You're such a sweet girl. I squat down to scratch her under her chin. She nips my finger. A playful love bite. Aren't you the most perfect little baby? I feel so fortunate to have met you. She gives me a disdainful look and turns away. I think she understands puns. Come on, I was just kitten. Another outraged glare. Then she jumps on a nearby cart, piled ceiling high with boxes and heavy, precarious-looking equipment. Where are you going? I squint, trying to figure out where she disappeared to. And that's when I realize it. The equipment, the precarious-looking equipment, it actually is precarious. and the cat poked it just enough to dislodge it, and it's falling on my head. Right about now. I have less than 3 seconds to move away, which is too bad because my entire body is suddenly made of stone, unresponsive to my brain's commands. I stand there, terrified, paralyzed, and close my eyes as a jumbled chaos of thoughts twists through my head. Is the cat okay? Am I going to die? Oh God, I am going to die. Squashed by a tungsten anvil like Wile E. Coyote. I am a 21st century Pierre Curie, about to get my skull crushed by a horse-drawn cart, except that I have no chair in the physics department of the University of Paris to leave to my lovely spouse, Marie. Except that I have barely done a tenth of all the science I meant to do. Except that I wanted so many things, and I never, oh my God, any second now. Something slams into my body, shoving me aside and into the wall. Everything is pain. For a couple of seconds. Then the pain is over and everything is noise. Metal clanking as it plunges to the floor. Horrified screaming. A shrill meow somewhere in the distance. And closer to my ear, someone is panting, less than an inch from me. I open my eyes, gasping for breath, and green. All I can see is green. Not dark like the grass outside, not dull like the pistachios I had on the plane. This green is light, piercing, intense, familiar, but hard to place. Not unlike eyes. I'm looking up into the greenest eyes I've ever seen. Eyes that I've seen before. Eyes surrounded by wavy black hair and a face that's angles and sharp edges and full lips. A face that's offensively, imperfectly handsome. A face attached to a large, solid body. A body that is pinning me to the wall. A body made of a broad chest and two thighs that could moonlight as redwoods, easily. One is slotted between my legs and it's holding me up, unyielding. This man even smells like a forest. And that mouth is still breathing heavily on top of me, probably from the effort of whisking me out from under 700 pounds of mechanical engineering tools and... I know that mouth. Levi. Levi! I haven't seen Levi Ward in 6 years. 6 blessed, blissful years. And now here he is, pushing me into a wall in the middle of NASA's Space Center, and he looks. Levi! Someone yells. The clanking goes silent. What was meant to fall has settled on the floor. Are you okay? Levi doesn't move, nor does he look away. His mouth works, and so does his throat. His lips part to say something, but no sound comes out. Instead, a hand, at once rushed and gentle, reaches up to cup my face. It's so large, I feel perfectly cradled, engulfed in green, cozy warmth. I whimper when it leaves my skin. A plaintive, involuntary sound from deep in my throat. But I stop when I realize that it's only shifting to the back of my skull, to the hollow of my collarbone, to my brow, pushing back my hair. It's a cautious touch, pressing but delicate, lingering but urgent, as though he is studying me, trying to make sure that I'm all in one piece, memorizing me. I lift my eyes, and for the first time I notice the deep, unmasked concern in Levi's eyes. His lips move, and I think that maybe, is he mouthing my name? Once and then again? Like it's some kind of prayer?
Levi! Levi, is she?
My eyelids fall closed, and everything goes dark. 3. Angular Gyrus. Pay attention. On weekdays, I usually set my alarm for 7 a.m., and then find myself snoozing it anywhere from 3, raving success, to 8 times. I hope a swarm of rabid locusts attacks me on my way to work, thus allowing me to find solace in the cold embrace of death. On Monday, however, the unprecedented happens. I'm up at 5:45, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. I spit out my night retainer, run into the bathroom, and don't even wait for the water to warm up to step under the shower. I am that eager. As I pour almond milk on my oatmeal, I give rad Dr. Curie the finger guns. Blink's starting today, I tell the magnet. Send good vibes, hold the radiations. I can't remember the last time I've been this excited. Probably because I've never been part of anything this exciting. I stand in front of my closet to pick out an outfit and focus on that. The sheer excitement, to avoid thinking about what happened on Friday. To be fair, there isn't much to think about. I only remember up until the moment I fainted. Yes, I swooned in his wardness's manly arms like a 20th century hysteric with penis envy. It's nothing new, really. I faint all the time. When I haven't eaten in a while, when I see pictures of large, hairy spiders, when I stand up too quickly from a sitting position. My body's puzzling inability to maintain minimal blood pressure in the face of normal, everyday events makes me, as Rika likes to say, a syncope aficionado. Doctors are puzzled, but ultimately unconcerned. I've long learned to dust myself off as soon as I regain consciousness and go about my business. Friday, though, was different. I came to in a few moments, Cat nowhere in sight, but my